The only other time Lindbeck had felt similarly was when a Viennese libertarian and critic of Keynes, Friedrich von Hayek, won. Hayek was so hated, so despised. He'd been in a very deep depression, he told me. It was terribly satisfying to indicate his greatness. The committee listened to Stahl, but it soon became clear that he wasn't going to win allies. The younger men, Svensson and Persson, were keen on a game theory prize, and the older ones weren't inclined to pick a fight with Lindbeck. The normal procedure when there are unresolved disagreements is to append a formal reservation, a minority opinion, to the committee report. Such reservations, which are duly reported to the full academy at the voting session, are not unheard of in physics or chemistry, and although they are not reported in the announcements at the time of the decision, they become part of the official record, and may be made public after 50 years. Things were different in the economics committee. Lindbeck was extremely proud of its record, and apparently regarded unanimity as necessary in maintaining the prize's credibility. As the report to the ninth class was being readied, Stahl threatened to register a formal reservation. In the end, whether because of pressure from Lindbeck, advice from his old friend Mailer, or simply a reluctance to go down in history as first to break the former pattern of unanimity, he did not. The class, which is used to going along with committee proposals, endorsed the proposal. To Lindbeck, this was the end of the matter. He had prevailed, as he usually did. He felt, however, that extraordinary measures were necessary to make sure that everything would go smoothly once the media furor broke. He took an unprecedented step. He telephoned Kuhn in Princeton and told him that it's 99% certain now that Nash would get the prize. The votes are unanimous, he told Kuhn, not giving any hint of the controversy. He gave Kuhn permission to inform the president of Princeton University of the impending award so that the university could make arrangements. As it turns out, Kuhn had to wait until after Labor Day to pass along his exciting news. Harold Shapiro, president of Princeton, was away on vacation. For once, Lindbeck, for all his political savvy, was wrong. It was not just that Stahl, who was far angrier than Lindbeck appreciated at the time, was a powder keg waiting to explode. Rather, Lindbeck's own long reign, and indeed the economics prize itself, were on shakier ground than he imagined. Powerful critics of both within the Academy, including a former Secretary General of the Academy and a number of prominent physicists, were itching to do something. This prize had become an issue for them. Few people outside Sweden, indeed few outside the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, realize how controversial, even vulnerable, the economics prize has been since its creation in 1968 and continues to be to the present. The economics prize has never been especially popular within the academy. Many people question the Nobel Prize in economics here, said one longtime member. Old-timers still thought it had been a grave mistake to add a new Nobel to the original prizes. They thought it cheapened the currency, and had, after the mistake of accepting the economics prize, successfully fought off efforts to establish other prizes that use the Nobel name. Erik Dahmen, an economist who was a close advisor to one of the rich families in Sweden, the Wallenbergs, calls it the so-called Nobel Prize in economics. He adds, "This is not really a Nobel Prize. It should never be spoken of together with the other prizes. The Academy should never have accepted the prize in economics. I have been against the prize since I became a member of the Academy." One physicist said, "The economics prize was just a way of jumping on the Nobel bandwagon, piggybacking on the Nobel." Economics was not held in high regard by many of the natural scientists who dominated the Academy. It is not, they said, a sufficiently scientific field to deserve equal footing with hard sciences like physics and chemistry. Ideas, they said, slipped in and out of fashion, but one could not point to scientific progress, a body of theories and empirical facts about which there was certainty and near universal agreement. Anders Carlquist, a physicist, said, "It's not as solid and big an enterprise as chemistry and physics." Lars Gordian, a mathematician at the Academy, for example, said later that Nash's prize was for a very small thing. Finally, there is a widespread feeling, particularly on the part of natural scientists and mathematicians, that the shallowness of the field was leading to a sharp and rapid decline in the quality of laureates. a decline that would necessarily worsen with time. Bengt Nagel, secretary of the Physics Nobel Prize Committee, jokingly quotes an economist who is supposed to have said in the early 1980s, "All the mighty firs have fallen. Now there are only bushes left." There are occasional calls to abolish the prize. After Myrdal won the prize, he is supposed to have suggested abolishing the prize because there were no longer any prize-worthy candidates. As recently as 1994, Kjell-Olof Feldt, the former Minister of Finance and soon to be chairman of the board of the Bank of Sweden, which finances the prize, suggested in a lengthy article in the Political Monthly that the prize be done away with. "But although many Academy members regret that the prize was established in the first place," said Carlqvist, "they realize that it's a fact of life." By 1994, in fact, the critics' objective was to wrest control of the prize from the economists. Lindbeck was personally unpopular. It was particularly galling that membership in the Economics Prize Committee seemed to be a lifetime sinecure, and that its members could choose winners without any real accountability to the Academy. In February, an Academy committee had suggested that the Economics Prize Committee be forced to operate by the same rules that apply to the Physics and Chemistry committees. The suggestion was not binding, but it was a warning note, the first concrete sign that critics of the prize were gaining momentum, and it carried with it the promise that the Academy Council would, when it got around to it, appoint another group specifically mandated to deal with the matter of the Economics Prize. The imposition, as for other standing committees, of term limits would, of course, have a drastic and immediate effect on the Economics Committee. It would eliminate Lindbeck, Mailer, and Stahl, the three longtime members, and virtually end their reign. The other and more drastic suggestion was to widen the membership to include non-economists, and most radically, to transform the Economics Nobel into, in effect, the Nobel Prize in Social Sciences, a notion that appealed not only to natural scientists, but also to the psychologists, sociologists, and other non-economists in the Academy's ninth class. Thus, the debate between Lindbeck and Stahl over whether Nash was a suitable candidate for the prize, a debate that really turned on whether the choice of Nash would embarrass the committee, took place in an unusually hostile atmosphere and under intense scrutiny. The future of the prize committee and the prize looked more vulnerable than they had in times past. All of these behind-the-scenes opinions and maneuvers explain why, between early September and early October, Stahl acquired a powerful set of allies who joined him for reasons quite apart from Nash's candidacy. The stage was set. In the end, Nash and the two other candidates for the 1994 Economics Prize passed by a mere handful of votes, the first in the history to skirt so close to defeat. It is a peculiarity, indeed a major administrative and logistical headache of the Nobel Prize process, that no award can really be said to exist until the members of the full body of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences have had their say. They have the sole right to decide, as a Nobel Foundation booklet puts it. Even a unanimous committee recommendation may be overruled. Only when the plenary session has cast ballots and the votes are counted and the results announced do the Secretary General and the members of the prize committee march off to telephone the winners. They then proceed to the sessions hall to announce the winners' names to the world press. Other prizes, like the Fields Medal for Mathematics or the John Bates Clark Medal for Economics, by contrast, are settled months ahead of time, their winners notified after a leisurely interval, and carefully instructed to sit on the secret until the awarding institutions get around to issuing their press releases or holding their festivities. Presumably, the inconvenience of the last-minute Nobel vote is outweighed by the benefit of being able to avoid leaks before the official announcement. The Nobel vote, moreover, is traditionally a mostly ceremonial affair, the final flourish after a lengthy selection procedure that is more or less completely dominated by the senior members of the prize committees. In the case of the Economics Prize, a few dozen random academicians, a fraction of the number who turn out for the Physics or Chemistry prizes, the other two Nobel awards administered by the Academy, assemble in the second week of October, largely for the pleasure of hearing a distinguished lecture on the proposed candidates' contributions to scientific progress. As one Academy member put it, members attend less for the vote itself than for a chance to hear the presentations. In some recent years, the modest quorum of 40 Academy members has proved difficult to achieve. According to the rules, Academy members have three options. They may vote for the candidate or candidates proposed by the committee and endorsed by the social sciences class. They may vote for an alternative candidate of their own choosing, or they may vote not to give a prize that year. The winner or winners must obtain a simple majority of votes. Until 1994, no candidates proposed by the committee had ever failed to gain a wide majority of votes. The Academy meeting that began promptly at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, October 12th, in a rather small, poorly lit auditorium tucked in a far corner of the Academy's ground floor, promised to be no more or less interesting than previous year's meetings. Fewer than 60 members were scattered around the room, but, as the officials present noted with satisfaction, there was no question of not getting a quorum. A couple of years earlier, 39 members had sat in that room waiting for a 40th, who did finally show up. Kirsten Fredge, the astrophysicist who was the Academy's president, and Carl Olaf Jacobsen were sitting side by side on the stage. The ballot box was perched at the end of the platform. The five members of the prize committee who belonged to the Academy were sitting near the front of the room. Lindbeck was at the podium in a few long strides. Wearing his thick black-rimmed glasses and usual frown of concentration, Lindbeck dove right into his subject, an overview of the entire process by which the committee had arrived at its recommendation for a prize in game theory. Always intense, Lindbeck stuttered with excitement, waved his long arms, and made a good many very dry jokes. He was followed by Jacobsen, low-keyed by contrast, who gave the official endorsement of the social sciences class. Both men claimed that the decisions by the committee as well as the class were, as always, unanimous. Lindbeck added that unanimity had come about as if by an invisible hand, his standing joke. Finally, Mailer got up and launched the main presentation, a lecture on the contributions of the three candidates. The lecture was quite disappointing. Mailer, never a brilliant speaker, was more nervous and unsure of himself than usual. He quickly became mired in technicalities and jargon. He read most of it. His wife had left him a few weeks earlier. He was agitated and depressed, and he had had a terrible time preparing the talk. All this took something like an hour. Had things proceeded as usual, there would have been a few rather perfunctory and mostly polite questions from the floor, perhaps a standard monologue by one of the old-timers about the dubiousness of the economics prize in the first place, before a general silence, a passing out of plain squares of white paper and number two pencils, quick scribbles, folding, and the drifting down of academicians to the stage to stuff their ballots in the box. Instead, all hell broke loose. Later, the president of the Nobel Foundation remarked wryly that Troy could only have been destroyed by someone inside the walls, and that's what happened here. No one recalls whether Stahl launched the first verbal grenade, but it was soon obvious to Lindbeck and Mailer that they were in the midst of an ambush. Stahl challenged Mailer to give a single major example showing that the theory had any empirical validity whatsoever. Mailer, who was in particularly poor shape to answer questions, fumbled. Stahl did not, contrary to a story 6 weeks later in Dagens Nyheter, one of Sweden's two dailies, do anything as crass or risky as to urge the Academy to withhold the prize to Nash because of the mathematician's mental illness. Instead, he argued forcefully and brilliantly that a prize for non-cooperative game theory was too narrow, too insubstantial, too technical. He reminded the audience that Nash's contribution had been made nearly a half a century earlier, and that it was more mathematics than economics. He derided Arzani and Zeltin for being boring, mere technicians. Other members of the audience soon chimed in. Stahl did not make the mistake of merely criticizing the committee's proposal, which, after all, he had signed. He had an alternative, he said. In light of the members' unhappiness, in light of unanswered questions, in light of Mailer's clearly unsatisfactory report, might it not be more prudent to postpone the prize in game theory? Why not vote instead to give the prize to Robert Lucas, the University of Chicago professor, whom the committee had virtually decided to propose for the following year? Everybody, he reminded them, was enthusiastic about Lucas, who had invented a theory to explain why government's efforts to manage the business cycle were doomed to failure, rational expectations, and was clearly one of the most important economists of the century. It was an unassailable choice. Lindbeck, who had at first seemed stunned by the audacity of Stahl's surprise attack, told the members in no uncertain terms what Stahl was implying. He reminded the members that Stahl had signed on to the game theory prize, and accused Stahl of wishing to scuttle the prize because of Nash's illness. He told the membership that it would be a grave injustice to withhold the prize. He did not tell them that, in an absolute breach of the Nobel rules, he had already informed Princeton University's president, Alicia Nash, and Nash himself that he was getting the prize. But those facts were very much in his mind as he appealed to the members. By the time Carl Olof Jacobsen called for the vote, the atmosphere in the room was tense and bitter. An unusually large number of academicians stayed to hear the vote count. Two members of the Academy, chosen by the President and Jacobsen, removed the ballots in front of the audience and tallied the votes. The paper was handed to Jacobsen, and Jacobsen read the votes one at a time. For Lindbeck it was, as he later said, a moment of unbearable suspense. Mr. Nash, Mr. Harzanyi, Mr. Zelton, Mr. Lucas. No prize. A few moments later, Fredge, Jacobsen, Lindbeck, and Mailer, very much shaken, were the only ones left in the room. Their candidates had gotten all that they needed, a slim majority of the votes. Later in public, these individuals would all deny that anything extraordinary had happened. They would pretend that Mailer's report had been unusually long, that there had been a great many questions, that the laureates had been difficult to reach, or simply state baldly that the delay had never occurred. But behind closed doors within the Academy there would be shock, consternation, and finger-pointing. "It was a unique event. It had never happened before," said one member of the Academy. "It's not good for the Academy to have close votes," said Kisselman. The very next day the Council hastily appointed an ad hoc committee to study the future of the economics prize. Afterward, a committee member friendly to Stahl would say that Stahl had been used by the physicists. Stahl's double-cross had backfired. Instead of being regarded as the man who saved the prize committee from an embarrassing mistake, he had set into motion the very consequences he feared. Like players in So Long Sucker, the game that Nash and his friends at Princeton had invented 40 years earlier, Lindbeck and Mailer formed a temporary coalition with the critics of the economics prize. They threw themselves behind the rules changes. They were determined to punish Stahl and get him off the committee, even if the new rules meant that they had to step aside as well. One prize committee member called their strategy elegant. Had Nash known about it, he would have appreciated it as a textbook execution of McCarthy's revenge rule, especially because Lindbeck could reasonably expect to get elected to the committee again after a 3-year interlude. But Stahl, who had provoked the scandal and compounded his sin by talking to a reporter, was out for good. The consequences did not end there. According to several members of the Academy, the ad hoc committee went on record to recommend changing the very nature of the economics prize. In its report, issued a few months later, in February 1995, the committee issued an instruction that essentially redefined the economics prize as a prize in social sciences, open to great contributions in fields like political science, psychology, and sociology. It also ordered the committee membership to be opened to 2 non-economists. No public announcement of these far-reaching changes was made, but within a year, Lindbeck, Mailer, and Stahl were gone. 2 social scientists who weren't economists, a statistician and a sociologist, were members of the prize committee, and among the top candidates for the prize was Amos Tversky, an Israeli psychologist who works on irrationality and decision-making. In the auditorium on October 12th, the 3 men rushed over to a small committee room. Jacobsen was armed with a page of telephone numbers for the laureates. It was he who would inform the laureates of the honor that was about to grace them. They tried to reach Zelton first, since Zelton was in Germany and, unlike Nash or Harzanyi, would not necessarily be asleep. It was early in the morning for Nash in New Jersey and the middle of the night for Harzanyi in California. As it turns out, Zeltan was out grocery shopping. Jakobsen then tried Harzanyi, and when he got him, quickly put Mailer, who knew Harzanyi well, on the line to quickly assure him, with much joviality, that Jakobsen was not some student or, worse, reporter playing a trick on him. Nash was the last to be called. Jakobsen waited expectantly as the telephone rang. Unbeknownst to most of Jakobsen's colleagues at the academy, he had a brother who, like Nash, had been diagnosed with schizophrenia as a young man in the 1950s and had been institutionalized ever since. It was a moment of incredible poignancy for Jakobsen. The greatest moment, he later said, of his 20-year tenure at the academy. He was unusually calm, he said afterward. That was my thought. He is taking this very calmly. Chapter 49. The Greatest Auction Ever. Washington, D.C., December 1994. On the afternoon of December 5, 1994, John Nash was riding in a taxi headed to Newark Airport on his way to Stockholm, where he would, in a few days' time, receive from the King of Sweden the gold medal engraved with the portrait of Alfred Nobel. At around the same time, a few hundred miles to the south in downtown Washington, D.C., Vice President Al Gore was announcing with great fanfare the opening of the greatest auction ever. There was, as the New York Times would later report, no fast-talking auctioneer, no banging gavel, no old masters. On the auction block was thin air, airwaves that could be used for the new wireless gadgets like telephones, pagers, faxes, worth billions and billions of dollars. Enough licenses for every major American city to have three competing cellular phone services. In the secret war rooms and bidding booths were CEOs of the world's biggest communications conglomerates, and an unlikely group of blue-sky economic theoreticians who were advising them. When the auction finally closed the following March, the winning bids totaled more than $7 billion, making it the biggest sale in American history of public assets, and one of the most successful and lucrative applications of economic theory to public policy ever. Michael Rothschild, dean of Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School, later called it a demonstration that people thinking hard about a problem can make the world work better. A triumph of pure thought. The juxtaposition of Gore and Nash, the high-tech auction, and the medieval pomp of the Nobel ceremony was hardly an accident. The FCC auction was designed by young economists who were using tools created by John Nash, John Harzanyi, and Reinhard Zeltan. Their ideas were specifically designed for analyzing rivalry and cooperation among a small number of rational players, with a mix of conflicting and similar interests, people, governments, and corporations, and even animal species. The prize itself was a long overdue acknowledgement by the Nobel Committee that a sea change in economics, one that had been underway for more than a decade, had taken place. As a discipline, economics had long been dominated by Adam Smith's brilliant metaphor of the invisible hand. Smith's concept of perfect competition envisions so many buyers and sellers that no single buyer or seller has to worry about the reactions of others. It is a powerful idea, one that predicted how free market economies would evolve and gave policymakers a guide for encouraging growth and dividing the economic pie fairly. But in the world of mega-mergers, big government, massive foreign direct investment, and wholesale privatization, where the game is played by a handful of players, each taking into account the other's actions, each pursuing his own best strategies, game theory has come to the fore. After decades of resistance, Paul Samuelson used to joke about this swamp of N-person game theory. A younger generation of theorists began using game theory in areas from trade to industrial organization to public finance in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Game theory opened up terrain for systematic thinking that was previously closed. Indeed, as game theory and information economics have become increasingly entwined, markets traditionally seen as fitting the purely competitive mold have increasingly been studied using game theory assumptions. The latest generation of texts used in top graduate schools today all recast the basic theories of the firm and the consumer, the foundation of economics, in terms of strategic games. Concepts, terminology, and models with game theory have come to dominate many areas of economics, said Avinash Dixit, an economist at Princeton who uses game theory in work on international trade and is the author of Thinking Strategically. At last we are seeing the realization of the true potential of the revolution launched by von Neumann and Morgenstern. And because most economic applications of game theory use the Nash equilibrium concept, Nash is the point of departure. The revolution has gone far beyond research journals, experimental laboratories at Caltech and the University of Pittsburgh, and classrooms of elite business schools and universities. The current generation of economic policymakers, including Lawrence Summers, Undersecretary of the Treasury, Joseph Stiglitz, Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, and Vice President Al Gore, are steeped in the stuff, which they say is useful for thinking about everything from budget proposals to Federal Reserve policy to pollution cleanups. The most dramatic use of game theory is by governments from Australia to Mexico to sell scarce public resources to buyers best able to develop them. The radio spectrum, T-bills, oil leases, timber, and pollution rights are now sold in auctions designed by game theorists, with far greater success than that of earlier policies. Economists like Nobel laureate Ronald Coase have advocated the use of auctions by government since the 1950s. Auctions have long been used in markets where sellers of unusual items, from vintage wines to movie rights, have no idea what bidders are willing to pay. Their basic purpose is to make bidders reveal how much they value the item. But the arguments of Coase and others were stated in abstract, entirely theoretical terms, and little thought was given to how such auctions would actually be conducted. Congress remained skeptical. Before 1994, Washington simply gave away licenses for free. Until 1982, it had been up to regulators to decide which companies deserved the licenses. Needless to say, the process was dominated by political pressures, outrageously expensive paperwork, and long delays. The pace of licensing lagged hopelessly behind market shifts and new technologies. After 1982, Washington awarded licenses using lotteries, with the winners free to resell licenses. Although the reform did speed up the granting of licenses, the process was still hugely inefficient and unfair. Bidders with no intention of operating an actual telephone business spent millions to get into the game for the purpose of reaping a windfall. Further, although telephone companies were forced to pay the costs of obtaining licenses, Washington and taxpayers did not get the benefit of any revenues. There had to be a better way. A young generation of game theorists, including Paul Milgrom, John Roberts, and Robert Wilson at the Stanford B School, came up with that better way. Their chief contribution consisted of recognizing, as Milgrom said, that the mere design of some auction wasn't enough. Getting the auction design right was also critically important. In particular, they concluded that the most obvious auction designs, auctioning licenses one by one in sequence using simultaneous sealed bids, was the way least likely to succeed in getting licenses into the hands of corporations that could use them best, Washington's stated objective. Game theorists treat an auction like a game with rules and try to evaluate how a given set of rules taken together is apt to affect the bidder's behavior. They take stock of the options the rules allow, the payoffs to the bidders associated with the options, and bidders' expectations about their competitors' likely choices. Why did these economists conclude that traditional auction formats would not work? Mainly because the value of each individual license to a user depends, as is the case with a Rembrandt or a Picasso, on what other licenses the user is able to obtain. Some licenses are perfect substitutes for one another. That would be the case for similar spectrum bands to provide a given service. But others are complements. That would be the case for licenses to provide paging services in different parts of the country. To permit the efficient license assignment, an auction must allow bidders to consider various packages of licenses, combining complements and switching among substitutes during the course of the auction. Designing an auction to allow this is quite difficult, writes Paul Milgrom, one of the economists who designed the FCC auction of which Gore was speaking. A second source of complexity, Milgrom says, is that the purpose of the licenses is to create businesses for new services with unknown technology and unknown consumer demand. Since bidders' opinions are bound to be wildly divergent, it is possible that license assignment would depend more on bidders' optimism than on their ability to create a desired service. Ideally, an auction design can minimize that problem. As Congress and the FCC inched closer to the notion of auctioning off spectrum rights, Australia and New Zealand both conducted spectrum auctions. That they proved to be costly flops and political disasters illustrated that the devil really was in the details. In New Zealand, the government ran a so-called second price auction, and newspapers were full of stories about winners who paid far below their bids. In one case, the high bid was 7 million New Zealand dollars, the second bid 5,000 New Zealand dollars, and the winner paid the lower price. In another, an Otago University student bid 1 New Zealand dollar for a television license in a small city. No one else bid, so he got it for $1. The government expected the cellular licenses to fetch 240 million New Zealand dollars. The actual revenue was 36 million New Zealand dollars, one-seventh of the advance estimate. In Australia, a botched auction in which parvenu bidders pulled the wool over the government's eyes delayed the introduction of pay television by almost a year. The FCC's chief economist was an advocate of auctions, but no game theorists were involved in the first stage of the FCC auction design. The theorist's phone started ringing only by accident, after the FCC issued a tentative proposal for an auction format with dozens of footnotes to the theoretical literature on auctions. That was how Milgram and his colleague Robert Wilson, leading auction theorists, got into the game. Milgram and Wilson proposed that the FCC adopt a simultaneous, multi-round auction. In a simultaneous auction, a bunch of licenses are sold at the same time. Multiple rounds means that after the first round of bidding, prices are announced, and bidders have a chance to withdraw or raise one another's bids. This is repeated round after round until the auction is over. The chief advantage of this format is that it allows bidders to take account of interdependencies among licenses. Just as sequential closed-bid auctions let sellers discover what bidders are willing to pay for individual items, the simultaneous ascending-bid auction lets them discover the market value of different groupings of items. This early proposal, which the FCC eventually adopted, did not cover seemingly small but critical details. Should there be deposits, minimum bid increments, time limits? Should the bidding system be wholly computerized or executed by hand? And so forth. Milgram Roberts and another game theorist, Preston McAfee, an advisor to AirTouch, provided proposals on these issues. The FCC hired another game theorist, John McMillan of the University of California at San Diego, to help evaluate the effect of every proposed rule. According to Milgram, game theory played a central role in the analysis of the rules. Ideas of Nash equilibrium, rationalizability, backward induction, and incomplete information, though rarely named explicitly, were the real basis of daily decisions about the details of the auction process. By late spring 1995, Washington had raised more than $10 billion from spectrum auctions. The press and the politicians were ecstatic. Corporate bidders were largely able to protect themselves from predatory bidding and were able to assemble an economically sensible set of licenses. It was, as John McMillan said, a triumph for game theory. Chapter 50, The Last Chapter. Reawakening, Princeton, 1995 to 97. Mathematics is a young man's game. Yet it is not bearable to contemplate a brief distinction and burgeoning of activity, followed by a lifetime of boredom. Norbert Wiener. On the afternoon of the Nobel announcement, after the press conference, a small champagne party was in progress in Fine Hall. Nash made a short speech. He was not inclined to give speeches, he said, but he had three things to say. First, he hoped that getting the Nobel would improve his credit rating because he really wanted a credit card. Second, he said that one is supposed to say that one is really glad he is sharing the prize, but he wished he had won the whole thing because he really needed the money badly. Third, Nash said that he had won for game theory. and that he felt that game theory was like string theory, a subject of great intrinsic intellectual interest that the world wishes to imagine can be of some utility. He said it with enough skepticism in his voice to make it funny. All the Swede's fears, not to mention Harold Kuhn's own private worries about how Nash would cope with the pomp in Stockholm, proved groundless. Everything went swimmingly. The receptions, the press briefings, the Nobel Awards ceremony itself, the lecture in Uppsala afterward. Indeed, in the weeks between the announcement of the prize and the ceremony, Nash did and felt things that had lain beyond his grasp for decades. When he first arrived in Stockholm, Jörgen Weibel recalled he behaved pretty much as Weibel had remembered from Princeton a few years before. He didn't look you in the eye, he mumbled. Socially, he was very tentative, very uncertain. But his mood went up from day to day. He got less and less unhappy. Harold Kuhn, who was to lead a Nobel seminar honoring Nash's work, and his wife Estelle, accompanied Nash and Alicia to Stockholm. It was exhilarating. The nicest moment of the week, so full of grand scenes and ceremonies, came when Nash had his much-dreaded private audience with the king. By tradition, the king spends a couple of minutes alone with each laureate. When Nash's turn came, he grimaced and frowned so much that Harold was afraid he might refuse to go into the king's chambers at the last minute. But finally he followed the aide inside. 5 minutes passed, then seven. Finally, after a full 10 minutes, Nash emerged looking relaxed, even amused. "What did you talk about?" everybody asked at once. Quite a bit, it turned out. In 1958, John told Harold and Estelle, he and Alicia had taken a grand tour of Europe and had driven up into the south of Sweden in their new Mercedes 180. The king had been a student in Uppsala then, addicted to fast sports cars. Around that time, the Swedes were shifting from driving on the left to driving on the right. Nash and the king had spent 10 minutes chatting about the pitfalls of driving fast on the left-hand side of the road. At dusk, Nash and Weibel were riding in a limousine through the countryside north of Stockholm. The farmhouses were lighting up one at a time. The sky was beginning to glimmer. Nash reached over to Weibel and said, "Look, Jörgen, it's so beautiful." They were on their way back from Uppsala, where Nash had given a talk, his first in 3 decades. Nash hadn't been asked to give the customary hour-long Nobel lecture in Stockholm. The lecture at the University of Uppsala was arranged by Christer Kisselman. Nash's chosen topic was a problem that had interested him before his illness, and that he had taken up again since his remission. Developing a mathematically correct theory of a non-expanding universe that is consistent with known physical observations. The conventional view, of course, is that the universe is expanding, and attempting to overturn the consensus is exactly the kind of contrarian intellectual bet that Nash has always enjoyed. Nash's talk on the possibility that the universe isn't expanding began with tensor calculus and general relativity, stuff so difficult that Einstein used to say he understood it only in moments of exceptional mental clarity. Although he later confessed to nervousness, he spoke without notes, clearly and convincingly, according to Weibel, who has a doctorate in physics. Physicists and mathematicians in the audience said afterward that Nash's ideas were interesting, made sense, and were expressed with the appropriate degree of skepticism. It is a quiet life, despite the fairy tale of Stockholm and the lofty status of laureate. The Nashes still live in the Inselbrick house with the hydrangeas out front, next to the alley and across from the Princeton train station. There's a new boiler, a new roof, a few new items of furniture, but that's about it. Nash was also able to pay down his half of the mortgage. The few friends they see regularly, among them Joe Manionero, Felix and Eva Browder, and of course Armand and Gabby Burrell, are pretty much the people they've been seeing for some years. Their daily routines have changed less than one might think, dominated as they are by the twin needs of earning a living and caring for Johnny. Alicia takes the train to Newark every day. Nash, who no longer drives, rides the dinky into town, eats lunch at the Institute and spends the afternoons in the library, or on rare occasions in his new office. Very often when Johnny is not in the hospital or on the road, he takes Johnny with him. It is a life resumed, but time did not stand still while Nash was dreaming. Like Rip Van Winkle, Odysseus, and countless fictional space travelers, he wakes to find that the world he left behind has moved on in his absence. The brilliant young men that were are retiring or dying. The children are middle-aged. The slender beauty, his wife, is now a mature woman in her 60s, and there is his own 70th birthday fast approaching. There are days when he feels that he has escaped the ravages of time, when he believes he can pick up where he left off, when he feels like a person who wants to do the research he might have done in his 30s and 40s at the delayed time of his 60s and 70s. In his Nobel autobiography, he writes, "Statistically, it would seem improbable that any mathematician or scientist at the age of 66 would be able, through continued research efforts, to add to his or her previous achievements. However, I am still making the effort, and it is conceivable that with the gap period of 25 years of partially diluted thinking providing a sort of vacation, my situation may be atypical. Thus, I have hopes of being able to achieve something of value through my current studies, or with any new ideas that come in the future." But many days he is not able to work. As Nash once told Harold Kuhn, "The Phantom was not in until very late, after 6 p.m., because even a phantom can have ordinary human problems and need to go to a doctor." And there are other days when he discovers an error in his calculations, or learns that a promising idea has already been mined by someone else, or when he hears of new experimental data that seem to make certain speculations of his seem less interesting. On such days he is full of regrets. The Nobel cannot restore what has been lost. For Nash, the primary pleasure in life had always come from creative work, rather than from emotional closeness to other people. Thus, recognition for his past achievements, while a balm, has also cast a harsh light on the vexing issue of what he is capable of doing now. As Nash put it in 1995, getting a Nobel after a long period of mental illness was not impressive. What would be impressive is persons who, after a time of mental illness, achieve a high level of mental functioning, and not just a high level of social respectability. Nash gave the starkest assessment of his own situation in front of an audience of psychiatrists to whom he had been introduced as a symbol of hope. In answer to a question at the end of his 1996 Madrid lecture, he said, "To recover rationality after being irrational, to recover a normal life is a great thing." But then he paused, stepped back, and said in a far stronger, more assertive voice, "But maybe it is not such a great thing. Suppose you have an artist, he's rational. But suppose he cannot paint. He can function normally. Is it really a cure? Is it really a salvation? I feel I am not a good example of a person who recovered unless I can do some good work." Adding in a wistful, barely audible whisper, "Although I'm rather old." These thoughts were much in Nash's mind when he turned down an offer of $30,000 from the Princeton University Press in 1995 to publish his collected works. "Psychologically, I have a problem since I have been, unfortunately, a long time without any publications," he said to Harold Kuhn. He was saying, in short, that he doesn't want to close the door on future work by acknowledging that his lifetime oeuvre is complete. As Nash says, "I did not want to publish a collected works simply because I wanted to think of myself as, and assume the posture of, a mathematician still actively engaged in research, and not just resting on his laurels, as they say. And of course I knew that if a collected works was not published at this time, then it could be published later, when hopefully I would have nice new things to add to it." In these feelings, however, he is not so different from his brilliant contemporaries. They too are having to face, or have already faced, the prospect that they are likely never to match their past achievements. Some have remained more active than others, but aging is a fact of life, and an especially stringent one for a mathematician. It is, for most of them, a young man's game. It takes extraordinary courage to return to research after a hiatus of nearly 30 years, but this is exactly what Nash did. As he told the Madrid audience, "I am again engaged in scientific study. I am avoiding routine problems, and instead I am dabbling." Nash had been thinking about a mathematical theory of the universe since before his meeting with Einstein. Since the lecture in Uppsala, he has suffered various setbacks. In August 1995, he said, "I got results that indicated I had made a fundamental error a long time ago and that I must reformulate the theory." Apparently, there was stuff being lost in a singular integration, and when I considered distributed matter instead of a point particle, I found the lost stuff, which had been erroneously ignored. Adding with characteristic objectivity that, "This is good since I have avoided publishing a version based on errors." He went on to describe the specific error. "There was a discrepancy in the field, which spoiled things. Recalculation revealed there had been errors in the calculation. Now I must finish up the calculation for a distributed mass of gravitating matter, at least to the first order level of approximation. This level itself could bring an interesting distinctive result." This evaluation of the difficulties encountered in his research gives a good idea that the problems Nash is working on are ambitious, that he has lost none of his taste for making high-risk bets, whether in ideas or stocks, and that his thinking is still sharp. And even if his chances of achieving a new breakthrough are statistically small, as he says, the pleasures of thinking about problems are once again his. The truth, however, is that the research has not been the main thing in his present life. The important theme has been reconnecting to family, friends, and community. This has become the urgent undertaking. The old fear that he depended on others and that they depended on him has faded. The wish to reconcile, to care for those who need him, is uppermost. He and his sister Martha, estranged for nearly 25 years, now talk on the telephone once a week. Johnny, of course, is the main thing, the constant. It was Nash who had told the women to call the police. Johnny had been living at home. He'd been all right for a while, but then he began to wear a paper crown. One afternoon he wanted some money. Because he believed he was a sovereign, he thought that he should be able to get money from Sovereign Bank. But the ATM in front of the bank would not spit out any cash. In fact, it would not return his bank card. Agitated and unhappy, Johnny called his mother, who has an account at Sovereign, and demanded she meet him at the ATM and get his card out of the machine. Alicia told John, who insisted on going with her. The couple tried vainly to extract Johnny's card. They also tried, unsuccessfully, to soothe Johnny. At that point, their son became enraged, picked up a big stick, and started to poke first his mother, then his father. Some bystanders across the street stopped when they saw the young man threatening the two elderly people. Nash shouted for one of them to call the police. A squad car pulled up. The police took Johnny, whom they knew well, back to Trenton State. Johnny was in the hospital when his parents got the news from Stockholm informing them of Nash's Nobel. Nash and Alicia called him first. He thought that they were pulling his leg, that it was a joke, and hung up on them. Later, he saw his father's face on CNN. The subject of Johnny's future is extremely painful. Nash had spoken matter-of-factly about it. Alicia, looking miserable, said nothing, and instead sank deep into her seat and closed her eyes. She finally interjected, "He just wants to get on with his life." The hopeful path that Johnny seemed to be on in his early 20s had long ago petered out. Whether because of the stress of teaching, the social isolation, or because the remission had simply run its course, the year at Marshall University was a disaster. He had come home and has not worked since. "Of course, I've been a bad example," Nash admits. Johnny wanted to get a job, Nash said, but he seemed to think he would be able to get one in a college mathematics department. He'd been writing letters introducing himself as the son of a Nobel laureate and asking for a position. Now Nash was telling the Kuhns that Johnny would not take his medicine when he was not in the hospital. Alicia adds, "He goes to the hospital, he gets better, but when he gets home he doesn't like to take his medication. Then he would get sick again, hearing voices and having delusions. He would be hospitalized again and get better, then it would start all over again." Watching over Johnny is now Nash's main task in life. Except when Johnny is on the road, wandering around the country on Greyhound buses, Nash is his caretaker. Nash takes it for granted that his son is his responsibility. As Nash said on one occasion, "My time of delusional thinking is presumably in the past, but my son's time of it is right now." They get up in the morning together after Alicia has gone to work. They eat breakfast together. Nash takes him to the library, to the institute, to Fine Hall. On Monday evenings, they all attend family therapy together. Nash has tried to get his son interested in the computer and plays computer chess with him. He has said, ultimately, computers could be a good sort of occupational therapy. As perhaps I was benefited in an OT, occupational therapy, fashioned by Hale Trotter's help, in letting me get familiar with computer use. Johnny is 38 years old. He's tall and handsome like his father, and he and his father share an interest in mathematics and chess. But Johnny's illness has dragged on for more than half his life, a quarter of a century. He has been treated with the newest generation of drugs, including Clozaril, Risperidol, and most recently Zyprexa. These drugs, which have enabled him for the most part to stay out of the hospital, have not given him a life. Time hardly passes for him. He no longer competes in chess tournaments, once his greatest joy. He no longer reads, saying that he has not been able to for a long time. He's often angry and occasionally violent. Life with Johnny is a tremendous strain on Nash and Alicia. Nash calls it being perturbed, tyrannized, and he is often preoccupied with the drift and danger of degradation. It is a constant disruption even when, as is often the case, Johnny is roaming around the country on Greyhound buses. For instance, Alicia and John go to the Olive Garden to celebrate Nash's birthday, and Johnny calls to say that he has lost his ATM card and has no money. The evening is spent wiring him funds. "We're at our wit's end," Alicia said recently. "You work so hard, and then he's out of it. The Nobel hasn't helped Johnny at all." Johnny draws Nash and Alicia together and tears them apart. There are deep conflicts. They blame each other for Johnny's misbehavior. When he destroys things in the house, attacks them, acts inappropriately in public, Nash feels that Alicia expects him to be the bad cop, a role he's not happy with, while she is the soft one. But they rely on each other. They agree every day on what one or the other should do. They also agree when it is time to hospitalize him. Nash is more judgmental and apt to hold Johnny responsible for his illness. He's sometimes quite cruel, telling Harold Kuhn and others at times that people like Johnny ought to be jailed, or that he has chosen to be as he is. "I don't think of my son as entirely a sufferer. In part, he is simply choosing to escape from the world." Despite such moments of insensitivity, the truth is that Nash expresses hope and pleasure when there is the prospect of a new medication, a new therapy, or when he gets an idea, like teaching Johnny how to play chess on the computer, that he thinks will help him. When his friend Avinash Dixit invites him for dinner, he immediately asks if he might bring Johnny along. At Dixit's, Johnny takes out a chess set and father and son sit down to play. Nash is less than mediocre. At one point, he says he wants to take back a bad move. Johnny lets him. Then Nash wants to take back another. "Dad, if you keep doing that, you'll win," says Johnny. "But when I play against the computer, I'm allowed to take back moves," Nash says. "But Dad," protests Johnny, "I'm not a computer, I'm a human being." When it is time to go to the pharmacy for Johnny's meds, Nash accompanies Alicia. When it is time to attend an open house at the outpatient program where Johnny is sometimes enrolled, Nash is there and on time. Alicia sees this and feels supported by him. She feels that she couldn't do without him. Marriage is easily the most mysterious of human relationships. Attachments that seem superficial can become surprisingly deep and lasting. Such is the bond between Nash and Alicia. In retrospect, one feels that this is not an accidental pairing, that these two people needed each other. Strong-minded, pragmatic, and independent as she is, Alicia's girlish infatuation has survived the disillusionments, hardships, and disappointments. She takes Nash clothes shopping. She frets when he travels that he'll be kidnapped by terrorists or killed in a plane crash or merely worn out when his ankle swells from perforation in the emergency room. More telling, she looks at an old photograph of him in bathing trunks at a poolside in California and says with a giggle, "Aren't his legs beautiful?" He, meanwhile, sets his clock by her. Stubborn, reserved, self-centered, and jealous of his time and money as he is, Nash does nothing without consulting Alicia first, defers to her wishes, and tries to help her, whether it is by washing the dishes, straightening out a problem at the bank, or going with her to family therapy every Monday night. She is the one to whom he faithfully reports the day's events, whom he ran into, what the lecture was about, what he ate for lunch. They argue about money, the housework, Johnny, social engagements, but he has committed himself to making her life easier, and is trying to be more sensitive and accommodating. He says self-critically, "I know I have my social faults, and I make Alicia very angry when she is saying something that I can anticipate before she's finished, and then I start saying something, as if what she's saying is not of importance." He accepts, with some humor, that his genius does not make him the authority on all matters. When it comes to financing their mortgage or choosing between gas and oil heat, he complains humorously that Alicia does not take him seriously as an economic sage, notwithstanding the Nobel. He does, of course, often wound her, but he catches himself, too, and makes amends. A typical exchange at Gabby and Armand Burrell's dinner party, Alicia announces to the assembled company that their son has received a tentative offer to teach mathematics at a small college in Mexico, an act of cruelty. "Yes," he says, "my son is in a mental hospital in Arkansas, but he got a job offer." He's laughing at the absurdity of this juxtaposition. This is too much for Alicia. "You have to be fair to Johnny," she returns. Nash says nothing. But later in the evening he goes to some lengths to make amends. He brings an offering, maps of Mexico, that he found in books on the Burrell's shelves, to Alicia. Information about Andrew Wiles's successful proof of Fermat's last theorem, to point out that Johnny had done some classical number theory and graduated. Johnny had published one correct result, one incorrect, but the correct one was a breakthrough of sorts, he tells the other guests. Alicia responds by paying attention, by taking in what he means. Much of the renewal of their marriage has taken place since the Nobel. There is now a sense of reciprocity. It is as if regaining the respect of his peers has made Nash feel that he has more to offer the people in his life, and has made those close to him, especially Alicia, feel that he has more to give. This has become self-reinforcing. At one time, before the Nobel, Alicia referred to Nash as her boarder, and they lived essentially like two distantly related individuals under the same roof. Now, there is even some discussion of remarrying, although in what was perhaps an assertion of Nash's old insistence on rationality, they gave the idea up as impractical, as so many older couples have in light of the attendant tax and Social Security penalties. However, a certificate is not of real importance. They are a real couple again. John Steer took the first step in ending his 20-year estrangement from his father, mailing him a copy of the June 1993 Boston Globe column that speculated on Nash's chances of winning a Nobel. He sent the clipping anonymously, but Nash immediately guessed its source. He was unsure whether to interpret John Steer's gesture as a taunt or a friendly overture. He told Harold Kuhn that something in the way the letter was addressed to him hinted at mockery, but the following February, 2 months after his triumph in Stockholm, Nash boarded a shuttle bound for Boston to spend a weekend getting reacquainted with his older son. Such an encounter, inspired by hopes of putting their sad history behind them, was bound to be bittersweet, an occasion that revived as many painful memories, disappointments, and misunderstandings as it unlocked happier feelings. When the two men finally met face to face, John Steer was no longer the 19-year-old Amherst College history major Nash remembered from their last encounter, but a man of 44, nearly as old as Nash had been in 1972 when they had last seen each other. Physically, he resembled his father to a striking degree. The impressive stature, broad shoulders, luminous eyes, English complexion, and finely molded nose were all Nash's. But in his life's choices and in his ability to derive great satisfaction from helping others, he was his mother's son. John Steer had stayed in Boston, remaining single, and pursuing a career as a registered nurse. At the time, he was thinking of returning to graduate school to obtain an advanced degree in nursing. In the 2 days they spent in each other's company, the most time they had ever been together at one stretch, they touched on personal topics only occasionally. Indeed, they were mostly with other people, It was important for Nash to have others confirm the reconciliation. They sat looking at old photographs with Eleanor, had a meal with Arthur Maddock, the closest friend of Nash's first family, and visited Marvin Minsky in his artificial intelligence laboratory at MIT. At one point, Nash telephoned Martha from John Steer's apartment and put his son on the phone. When father and son did venture into personal territory, Nash was, as usual, full of the best intentions. He wished to show his son how vitally important he was to him. He wanted to share with him some of his own recent good fortune. He wanted to give him the benefit of paternal advice. He was motivated by love and by a sense of responsibility. He told John that he would divide his estate equally between him and his brother, and he invited him to accompany him to a conference in Berlin. All this was to the good. But as in so many other relationships in his life, Nash's intentions weren't always matched by the emotional means to carry them out satisfactorily. Even as he tried to draw his son closer, he said and did things that could only be called insensitive and alienating. He did not try to hide his own feelings of disappointment. He criticized his son's appearance, calling him fat, which he is not. He criticized his son's choice of profession, suggesting that nursing was beneath a son of his and urging him to go to medical school instead of pursuing a master's in nursing. He hinted strongly that he hoped John would help care for his younger brother, but then angered him by saying it would do Johnny good to be around a less intelligent older brother. Finally, he said he wanted John to change his name to Nash, a suggestion meant to be magnanimous, but which actually proved hurtful, since it implied that he meant for John to renounce all that he was and had been. Eleanor, of course, felt injured. A few months later, Nash did take John Steer to Berlin with him. The tensions of their first reunion surfaced again. Nash remorselessly needled his son about trifles, making him turn out the light when he wanted to read, not letting him order dessert, telling him not to eat butter or bread. Yet even so, John Steer felt great pride when Nash gave his lectures, and Nash was able to write to Harold Kuhn, "Berlin was a great experience. My son enjoyed the trip." A Nobel Award has a finality about it. Yet despite the unique honor, life continues beyond the fairy tale celebration in Stockholm. More so than for other laureates, Nash's immediate future is uncertain. Nobody knows whether his remission is permanent. People have relapsed after many years of being symptom-free. The present is precious. Unlike a game of Hex, outcomes in real life aren't predetermined by the first or even the 50th move. The extraordinary journey of this American genius, this man who surprises people, continues. The self-deprecating humor suggests greater self-awareness. The straight-from-the-heart talk with friends about sadness, pleasure, and attachment suggests a wider range of emotional experiences. The daily effort to give others their due and to recognize their right to ask this of him bespeaks a very different man from the often cold and arrogant youth, and the disjunction of thought and emotion that characterized Nash's personality, not just when he was ill, but even before, are much evident today. Indeed, if not always in word, Nash has come to a life in which thought and emotion are more closely entwined, where getting and giving are central and relationships are more symmetrical. He may be less than he was intellectually, he may never achieve another breakthrough, but he has become a great deal more than he ever was. A very fine person, as Alicia put it once. As we leave him now, he is perhaps just hurrying under the Eisenhart Gate on his way to Fine Hall, or sitting next to Alicia on the living room sofa watching Doctor Who on the big television, or losing a game of chess to Johnny, or spending 105 minutes on the telephone comforting Lloyd Shapley after his wife's death, or giving Harold Kuhn a look like a naughty boy's when Harold asks whether the lecture notes for Pisa are ready, or sitting at the Institute math table with his lunch tray, nodding while Enrico Bombieri, who has just read the love letters of Carrington, bemoans the lost art of letter writing, or after listening to an astronomy lecture, gazing through a telescope at some distant star, glimmering in the night sky. Acknowledgements. Many people contributed to this book, two above all. My friend of 25 years, Ellen Tremper, who cheered me on and rendered invaluable assistance every step of the way, and Harold W. Kuhn, whose enthusiasm for the enterprise and intimate knowledge of John Nash and the mathematics community, was a constant source of guidance and inspiration. No one could have done more. I am deeply indebted to Alicia Lardé Nash and Martha Nash Legge, without whose support I could not have embarked on this biography, much less completed it. I am also grateful to John David Steer, Eleanor Steer, and John Charles Martin Nash for their cooperation. No author was ever in better hands than those of Alice Mayhew, my editor, and Kathy Robbins, my agent. I am thankful to Amartya Sen and Philip Griffiths for enabling me to spend a vital year as a director's visitor at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. Giancarlo Rota for a shorter but equally critical interlude at the MIT Mathematics Department, and Vivian Arterberry for a productive week at the Rand Corporation. Joseph Lelyveld, Soma Golden Bear, and Glenn Kremen of the New York Times granted me a generous leave of absence and enthusiastic support. My colleagues Doug France at the New York Times and Rob Norton at Fortune gave much appreciated advice and encouragement at every stage. Avinash Dixit, Harold Kuhn, Roger Meyerson, Ariel Rubinstein, and Robert Wilson patiently shared their insights about game theory and served as valuable sounding boards. Donald Spencer, Harold Kuhn, Lars Hormander, Michael Artin, Joseph Cohn, John Milner, Louis Nirenberg, and Jürgen Moser worked hard to help me convey the originality of Nash's contributions to pure mathematics clearly and accurately. Superb Histories by John MacDonald, William Poundstone, Fred Kaplan, and David Halberstam provided much of the context for Nash's tenure at Rand. Ed Regis's lively history of the Institute for Advanced Study and Rebecca Goldstein's delightful novel The Mind-Body Problem were also invaluable. Richard Jed Wyatt guided me through the vast and fascinating literature on schizophrenia. The extraordinary work of Louis Sass, Anthony Storr, John Gunderson, Kenneth Kendler, Irving Gottesman, Richard Keefe, James Glass, K. Redfield Jameson, and E. Fuller Torrey provided inspiration as well as important information. Special thanks to Connie and Steve Lieber, the founders of the National Alliance for Research on Schizophrenia and Depression, for their interest in this project. Psychiatrists Paul Howard, Joseph Brenner, Robert Garber, and Peter Baumecker provided first-hand descriptions of the institutions where Nash was treated and glimpses into the mysteries of clinical psychiatry. Jörgen Weibel and other members of the Economics Prize Committee and the Swedish Academy of Sciences were wonderfully hospitable during my visit to Stockholm and helped me decipher the seemingly inscrutable process by which the knee plus ultra of honors is bestowed. Sociologist Harriet Zuckerman's landmark study of Nobel laureates served as an excellent roadmap. Lloyd Shapley's loving and lovely phrase, "A Beautiful Mind," became, at Kathy Robbins's suggestion, the title of the book. I'm infinitely grateful to the hundreds of individuals, mathematicians, economists, psychiatrists, and others who knew John Nash, who supplied the memories from which I've woven together his remarkable story. Every fragment, however tiny, added to the vividness of the whole, and each was gratefully received and treasured. In addition to those already cited, I am particularly indebted to Paul Samuelson, Arthur Maddock, Paul Cohen, Odette Lardé, Dorothy Thomas, Peter Lacks, Kathleen Morowetz, Donald Newman, Al Vasquez, Richard Best, John Moore, Armand Gabby Burrell, Zipporah Levinson, Jerome Newworth, Felix and Eva Browder, Leopold Flatto, John Danskin, Emma Duchesne, and Joyce Davis. Archivists and librarians at Carnegie Mellon University, Princeton University, MIT, Harvard University, the Institute for Advanced Study, the Rockefeller Archive Center, McLean Hospital, the Swiss National Archives, and the National Archive provided important material and expert guidance. Special thanks to Arlen Hastings, Momota Gungali, and Elise Hansen at the Institute for Advanced Study for making my year at the Institute so productive, and to Richard Wolff for sharing his knowledge of the Cambridge intellectual community. Ellen Tremper, Jeffrey O'Brien, Harold Kuhn, Avinash Dixit, Lars Hormander, Jürgen Moser, Michael Arden, Donald Spencer, Richard Wyatt, and Rob Norton read and commented on various drafts. Their painstaking efforts eliminated mistakes, improved expositions, and added important new insights. All errors that remain are, of course, mine. My husband Daryl MacLeod and children Clara, Lily, and Jack not only lived with this book and its harried author for 3 years, but pitched in on the computer in the library around the house when deadlines were looming and the sky seemed about to fall. For their love and patience, I am most indebted. This concludes the reading of A Beautiful Mind by Sylvia Nasser. Thank you.